The Man in Line with Andy Wint.
Michelle Haywood MHK is on Man in Line today. Russian MHK, of course, elected in 2021. And until recently was the Minister at the Department of Infrastructure. So anything you want to chat about, whether it's about the South, politics in general, and in particular, Pastor Mike, good afternoon.
Pastor Mike, Andy.
In particular.
In particular. There was a hanging in particular. There,
in particular. It's abuse, online abuse. Oh. Online abuse of politicians, something which I know you have suffered from in the past. And you talked about the fact that when your family's brought into it and it's on personal pages and what have you. What are we going to do about this? Because this online abuse and certainly social media interaction doesn't seem to be dissipating.
No, the island has a real love affair with Facebook. I think it's used far more here than it is in neighbouring jurisdictions. And there is a complete sort of communications sort of culture almost that runs through that. I don't know how you persuade people that their interaction should be honest and genuine and respectful. And I think the only way that I can see that you work your way out of it is that you shine a spotlight on those interactions that don't meet those standards and that you call people out on it. And I think some of what I've done recently has certainly done that. And all it does is seem to provoke a level of abuse from the abusers. And I suspect after today's programme link goes up on the radio, you'll see it again in the comments there, and it is just tiresome. I'm sure these people are far more intelligent than their comments betray them to be.
What's the worst you've had?
I've had threats against me, and I've had threats against my children as well.
I mean, what would provoke anybody? What must be going on in somebody's mind to think that that's a good thing to do?
I genuinely don't know. I'm stumped as to why on an island that has so much to offer, our communities are so busy. You know, there's so much going on in the arts and sports, and there's such a beautiful country to go and explore and to take advantage of those amazing views and landscapes that we have. Why anyone feels the need that they have to sit in and just exist in the little sort of colony that's online. And it's self-perpetuating as well. It feeds, you can see the bubbles grow as it acts like an echo chamber. And I really, you know, I kind of wish these people peace. I wish that they'd find something else to do with their lives that was more meaningful.
Have you ever considered butting out yourself and just thinking, I'm not going to go on Facebook anymore, I'm not going to interact with people who are going to insult me?
I've stepped back quite a lot from that, but when I published that I was on my MHK's page, that actually I retain editorial control over that page, and I was going to block comments or hide comments from people if they were just being abusive and I wasn't going to interact, that sparked a whole load of discussion about whether I had the right to block comments. Of course I have the right not to sit there and be abused. If you want to discuss policies, fine. If you want to discuss political decisions, fine. If you want to be abusive, not fine.
It happens in the UK, doesn't it? Certainly happens in America. So is this just a consequence of modern day politics?
I feel everyone got angrier after COVID when you saw what
really?
Governments. Yeah, I do. I think when you saw what governments could do and how much they could impact on your lives and how much they could shut down what your day to day activities were, and we were all sent home, and you know, we were only allowed into the supermarket 2 meters apart, and things were being rationed. I think that scared people, and it made a lot of people feel unsafe in the life that they thought that they had and the privileges that they thought they had in life. And I think from that point on, you can almost track this kind of angrier narrative, an anti-science narrative. Certainly, you know, the right-wing arguments that are playing out in the UK and trying to refocus and blame everything on immigrants as though that's the kind of, you know, the solution to everything is to fix an immigrant problem that probably doesn't exist because you've kind of created it rather than it being a genuine problem. And I think that that narrative has kind of built, we see an angrier sort of community almost. But I'm interested because Kurt Rusin has recently published a book, and he actually includes in that that 51% of accounts on Facebook are actually bots, they're fake accounts. So less than half those interactions are likely to be real people. And he puts forward the idea that you only need about 3% of comments on Facebook to be against something. And it can look like, because of the influence of bots, which obviously, you know, drives the algorithms, it drives clicks. Yeah. If you can rile people up and you can rage bait them, that actually it looks like that's amplified the message. And that looks like a whole community is against something. And when it actually, in real numbers of real people, it's a very, very small number.
And if you transpose that across the Western world, and as you say, a large proportion are robots, they're just something that's been created, surely the tech companies have a lot to answer for, because they know how to stop that.
They do, but they exist then to sell advertising space, and the more people, the more interactions that you've got going on, the more people are drawn back to using the platform because they were so cross about something, they're going to go and check the comments or the notifications keep pinging up, so they go back on there, the more likely they are to see the adverts and the more revenue those companies can be making right. from it. And so you are being, you know, it's fine asking the tech companies to police this space, but it's not in their interest to financially. And so the psychology of you know, driving people to interact with that is quite interesting.
So do you think the ordinary public, we'll finish this in a minute because we could talk about this all day, but do you think the public know they're being played?
I think some of them do. I think some of them will use Facebook for very specific purposes. They'll go on to check their buy and sell classified ads or something if they're looking for something. And that seems to have displaced, we used to have the Manx.net, you know, sales page, didn't we? So that's kind of displaced that now as being a local way of selling, or the, you know, free cycle pages or the lift share pages, all of those. And the community groups are on there. I think people, there are some people who just limit themselves to that. And then there are those that go on there just to have an argument, because that's something that, you know, obviously gives them their dopamine hit for the day.
Okay. Right, we'll leave that there for the moment. Let's go to Port St. Mary. And Carolyn dropped a note in just to say, as a former commissioner, what can you say about the future of Port St. Mary and its dying retail sector?
The retail space in Port St. Mary has been constrained now for many years. You know, we have a road called the High Street, doesn't actually have any, hardly any shops on it anymore, and all of the retail area is concentrated at the top end of the village. I think with the reopening of Manxonia House and the new pantry shop that's gone in there at Keller's, there is very little empty retail space in Port St. Mary at the moment. And so I'm not sure that I necessarily right. agree. I know when I first Ports of Call. Call it Bolton have moved across into there because right. Keller's are expanding into their old premises at the end of Manxonia House. I think there might be a couple of the smaller units at the back that are empty. But actually, when I became a commissioner, almost half those shop units were empty. And, you know, it goes back 10 years or so. But we've steadily seen, and I know I defended some planning applications to convert some of those shops into residential, and you'd lose them all together. And I sort of, you know, wrote quite a strong rebuttal against that to the planning committee. But those shops are, you know, they're all in use and fairly busy now. So I think it doesn't look bad for Port St. Mary, but Port St. Mary will be constrained by the amount of space that it has available for retail.
What's your view on the Bay Queen development?
I've had the privilege of touring it twice, actually. I went just as they were coming above the underground car park level and all the services were going in and pouring the first floor. And then I've been since they've capped out as well and they were doing first fit. It's a really impressive development. Hertford Homes have taken considerable amount of care in how they've designed and kitted out the building. And I think that it's so insulated that they're actually worried about it'll be too warm inside the buildings. They are a really impressive set of apartments yeah. that have been built there. And I'm looking forward to seeing what goes on the ground floor, because there's a retail sort of commercial space down there as well.
Are they going to be people who live in the village, or will there be absentee tenants, do we know?
There are already some people living in the building, so I think there are three units that are already occupied, and there were some people who bought off plan and so have, you know, been committed to this project for a couple of years now. I know that I think one of the top floor, one of the penthouse that is split into two on the top floor, one of those was somebody who was local. But if people are buying them as an investment, you know, that's equally valid.
And how, I mean, you may or may not know this, but what's the structural situation now with the beach and the walks around there? Because there was a landslip a wee while ago, wasn't there?
Yeah, the when I was still Minister, the Department of Infrastructure had agreed that they were going to take responsibility for dealing with the lands, the area of the landslip, and just shoring up the path that's above it. It looks like it was just caused by a torrent of water that came down on Hopchinay, I think, caused some flooding in the shops and caused that to happen. So they were waiting for the ground to stabilise so they can go in and do the works.
Okay. Dennis said, are they still doing the cinema nights on Fridays in Port St Mary?
We're not at the moment. The numbers dropped quite low, and so it got to the point of not really being worth doing. So I've kind of suspended those for the moment. We have just been setting up for Pride this year. So at the end of June, there will be two nights in connection with the Pride Film Festival.
Okay. Because people who like them love them. The Friday night cinema nights.
They do. There was a regular crowd of people that came in. Numbers need to be high enough to cover the costs for doing it.
Right.
And things were getting a little bit busy and a little bit hectic in life, and the numbers were dropping, and so I made the decision just to suspend it for now. But I've still got the cinema licence.
Yeah,
so.
For new listeners, start here. It was a Friday night cinema night. Basically, take your own grub, take your own drink, and watch the cinema. And it was a communal thing for Port St Mary.
Yeah, it was. It was really popular for some of the nights we ran. And then some of the nights just didn't seem to get the traction. And so, you know, you need a certain amount to cover the cost of showing the film and the cost of hiring the hall. And then it was raising funds that way. And some of the nights that weren't so popular, you ended up sort of cross-subsidising them.
Right.
So at the moment, it's suspended.
What was the most popular one?
Oh, a Rocky Horror Picture Show. Are you coming in an outfit next time? I think we're showing it in June. So, you know, if you'd like to dress up, it's a Saturday night one.
Anyway, here's a message in. This is from, let me see here. I would have called, but I'm stuck in Manchester after my EasyJet flight this morning was delayed by almost an hour and I missed my connection. The delay was due to air traffic control again. I'm not the only one affected. Perhaps you could ask the ex-minister, is there any possibility of the airport maintaining a competent service anymore? How was there such a failure to look at succession planning? Frustrating, embarrassing, and not to mention the stress and inconvenience and expense caused by a failure of the airport to plan ahead. I can only sympathise with people travelling with children and business travels trying to meet a deadline. I feel that I should be compensated by the airport, as it was entirely the airport's fault. Does she agree?
I don't know what the circumstances are for this morning, and I'm not in a position to ask about those. I do know that airlines often say it's air traffic control when it's nothing to do with air traffic control. So I think you probably would need to write to the airport and ask them about the specific circumstances. But I do agree with your caller that the failure to do succession planning, but that goes back to it goes back to COVID times again. You know, when the airlines all stopped operating and everyone was sent home, a lot of people left the industry and left the sector, and then it's taken a long time to build back up to those levels again. And the airport's been tackling that in two ways: one, by training people from scratch and training them up, and the other by recruiting experienced air traffic controllers and bringing them in, and then doing, like, sort of, I was going to say the conversion course, but teaching them about how it works at the Isle of Man airport, which is quite different to some of the airports they're likely to have worked at before.
Trouble is, of course, if they train people up, there's no guarantee they're going to stay.
No, well, there's no guarantee unless you make it the culture that they want to stay in.
Yeah.
And quite a few of the people that have been trained up were local people anyway, so I think they're committed to being here on the island and to supporting the island's needs.
Well, I think the other bit, I mean, I've spoken to people and people have been on talking about this, saying, obviously, if you're an air traffic controller, this is not the busiest airport. So if you want high volume, this isn't the airport to be at. But for an air traffic controller who would suit the life, this is a great place to be. So you just, I think the public just wonder why there is this ongoing situation.
It was due to low staffing numbers, and there was a well-publicised pay dispute as well with the air traffic controllers, and that's all been resolved. But it takes time to get people through training. And at the end of their training, it's not that you just hand them their certificate and let them loose. There's an exam that they need to pass as well. So you need to get people through that pipeline. And the airport has been steadily steadily working back to being fully staffed. But as I say, I genuinely don't know whether it was a genuine air traffic control problem this morning. There are still a limited number of publicised closures that the airlines will know about and have to work around. But I know of examples where you've had a late running flight into the island, which means it's trying to land at a point when they know the airport is already closed, but they'll blame it on that, even though it was baggage handling at their departure airport that caused the issue. So it's always really hard to unpick this, and I'm afraid that it's not in the airline's interest to necessarily publicise that they may have not managed to make their flight time in. So these situations are always quite complicated.
Okay, well, we're juggling calls and questions today, so let's get a call. Oh, Julian's with us now. Hi, Julian, you're live with Michelle Haywood, MHK.
Hi, Michelle, and welcome back, Andy.
Well, thank you.
Hello.
Hi, Michelle. I noticed recently in Tynwald some proposed amendments to your safe access zone bill. One of them is an addition to the definition of premises that can have an access zone, and that is vehicles. Does this mean travelling access zones? What happens if your anonymity clause applies to any of these vehicles? How will anyone know if they're breaking the law? And this leads to the bigger question. How will the rule of law be maintained if there's any ambiguity in where and what a semi-secret access zone is, making it potentially unforeseeable to avoid, especially if you've got any other activity in your categories?
Thanks for that. Yes, it does mean vehicles, because we became aware when we were talking to various people that, of course, you can have mobile vaccination clinics, or you could have mobile X-ray clinics. And so that defining a premises as a vehicle for the purposes of that was a sensible inclusion in the bill. No, that doesn't mean travelling access zones. The premises would only be protected at the time when it was offering services. And generally, you don't tend to vaccinate people in a moving vehicle, so that would be clearly nonsense. And I'm going to push back against your semi-secret. The concept that these zones it's written quite clearly in the bill about having to be publicised in an appropriate way. There are some locations for which publishing a location may be detrimental to the people who are using that services. For example, perhaps in social care settings, where publicising certain residential care locations may be prejudicial to everyone who lives there. However, the bill does clearly state that the department would have to find a way of making sure that those that needed to know about it did know about it. And the first step in any issue that happens around those is actually just a warning. So it would be a warning from a police constable or to say to people, did you know this is infernal? So it's not that you step straight into deciding that somebody is guilty and issuing a fixed penalty notice or taking them to court. It would be a warning to say, just so you know, this is now a zone where you cannot approach vulnerable service users, and you cannot accost them, and you cannot try to persuade them. And I think that's right. I genuinely believe that people have the right to access services without being accosted. And exactly the same provisions exist already in the Abortion Reform Act.
Okay. Briefly, if you would, Julian, what are your misgivings?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think you've just highlighted my point. I mean, your Section 13, paragraph 3A says the department must publish a list in such a way as appears to the department to be appropriate to maintain the anonymity of any protected premises. So this is my point. If there's an anonymity aspect to this, won't this also put a lot of extra pressure on the police and be potentially divisive between them and the public? I suppose the other question I could ask Michelle is, over the past few years, which incidents would have been prevented by your safe access zone legislation, considering we already have the Harassment and Public Order Acts in place?
So harassment's an interesting one. Harassment only applies if you repeatedly approach the same person with the same behaviour and they are in fear of violence. And I know from experience, I've been visiting one of the scientific companies on the island when staff were being harassed in the car park as they arrived to work, and it was causing considerable distress. And I spoke to the staff at the time and they said, this happens periodically, never targets the same person, generally the same same arguments, but, you know, from the moment I park the car, there I am being shouted at and abused until I can get in the door of the building. And there were members of staff who were decided to leave employment with that company rather than carry on facing that as you go into work each morning. And that is just not acceptable behaviour. So whichever way you cut it, I'm not going to try and find something that defends people who will do that sort of behaviour. If you are engaged in a legal activity, if you are providing services that are legal services to provide, and you have service users or staff involved with those services, then you have a right to go into those services without being accosted.
Okay, Julian, thanks for calling today.
Thanks very much. Cheers.
Okay, now, Katrina Baptist, this Peel Town Commissioner, has raised serious concerns about governance and transparency within local authorities. And I'm trying to remember, when did you... Was it Clause 5, when we were talking about Clause 5 and the famous corruption quote that came out?
When I said there was a potential for corruption within local authorities.
Yeah,
so that's not particularly around Clause 5. So the entire of the Local Government Amendments Act has a number of different sections that it's amending. One of those sections is particularly around declarations of members' interests and officers' declarations of interest as well.
Right.
So this doesn't just apply to elected members, but it would also apply to those that are employed as clerks or deputy clerks or finance officers, that they would have to specify when either they or somebody who was closely related to them had a financial interest in matters.
Do you read anything into what's happening in Peel, what you've heard?
Peel have... I know I had discussions with the chair of Peel as we got the Local Government Amendments Act back into play and we're starting to try and get it through the legislative process. And I had a long conversation with the chair at the time, and he was objecting to the idea that they would have to publish minutes or they'd have to publish accounts and that those things were available but just to Peel ratepayers. And my view then, and it's still the same, was that actually, no, those things should just be public information anyway. We were charged back with, well, but that's the sort of rules that apply to really large councils across in England. And the rationale for it here is that all of our local authorities are rate-raising bodies. They impose a tax on you that you have no ability to argue. You know, once they've decided what the rates level is for the year, that's your bill that you're getting. And so if you have tax-raising powers like that, then you also have to have some responsibility for publishing your accounts and publishing your minutes and your decisions and for ensuring that those are all taken in an open and transparent way so that there can be no suspicion on behalf of your communities that somebody got a backhander or somebody awarded the contract to their cousin or whatever it was. All of those bits are really, really important for good governance. So I know Peel was one of the ones that pushed back against having to publish information, and the amendments that are coming through will actually require them to do so, and I think that's absolutely right.
I mean, as I say, Katrina Baptist is the one who's just saying minutes are inaccurate, communication's poor, and some decisions aren't being properly recorded. How can that happen?
I think I could go back to my own experience when I was in Portsmouth area, and we had a very similar experience where I was writing my own notes during meetings, because when the minutes eventually appeared and it would be just before the next month's meetings when people's memories are starting to fade, we'd spend sometimes nearly an hour and a half going through correcting the minutes of the previous meeting to try and get things right. And I think there is there is a possibility that if you've got somebody who's not producing accurate minutes, that things can get lost. I'd love to encourage everyone to use technology now. So, you know, turn on Copilot or whatever technology format you want to use and get AI to draft you up a summary of the meeting, or at least record a transcript of it that you can all look through. Once you've agreed everything's captured, it can be deleted. I think certain government departments have been moving towards that, and it is about working smarter rather than harder. There is an art to, particularly if you're the clerk in a meeting and you're trying to advise members and you're trying to take minutes at the same time, you can't be talking, listening and writing simultaneously. That becomes very difficult, and I think you could be using technology just to make this so much smoother for everyone.
Okay. Clause 5, I think, comes up. Is it tomorrow?
I believe so. However, we have met with the minister this morning, and I think there's a possibility that it might be adjourned tomorrow.
Okay. Just going back to the local authority issue, bearing in mind sometimes it's difficult to get people to get involved in local politics. The fact that sometimes it may not appear to be entirely straightforward. It may be entirely straightforward behind the scenes, but if it doesn't appear to be straightforward, that could put some people off, couldn't it?
I think so. And I think a lot of people who consider going into a local authority come from a professional background and expect certain standards of behaviour.
Right.
And there is the members' code of conduct that's there. And the Local Government Amendments Act will update some of the kind of the requirements within that and bring them into line with modern standards. And I think it can be incredibly difficult sometimes when you first join a local authority, because matters are already ongoing and you're not necessarily party to kind of previous decisions. So it can take a little while to get up to speed, but then I think there is a potential sometimes within local authorities that small cliques occur, so that the chair and perhaps the vice chair make decisions with the clerk and maybe the rest of the board aren't informed. So I think it's beholden on all chairs of all local authorities to act in a way that includes all their board members in the decision making and is open and transparent, and that they can explain and justify those decisions to their ratepayers when challenged.
A message in then also from Dennis, who just said, so we've talked about in the past, or it's been postulated in the past, the 4+1 theory of a north-south east and west local authorities and Douglas, and get rid of all the other authorities. 4+1, where do you stand on that?
Local authority reform was one of the things that this administration decided not to tackle. It looked at, you know, if you look back at the island plan, there's a clear gap in there. I think, however, there are some recent events and things that will push that further onto the agenda, and I expect that the next administration will probably have to tackle local authority reform. Whether it's down to the 4+1 model, I don't know. I think there are some synergies and some savings to be had. If you're a clerk, you have to be expert in HR and employment matters and health and safety matters, and you know, you're all over the sort of financial stuff as well, and that's asking an awful lot to have that sometimes down at quite a small level for each local authority. So I think some shared clerking in there would probably be advantageous. But I'm a huge fan of having local offices where you can walk in and talk to local people who are responsible for local services as well. And maybe there's something in there chimes with the government's current stated aim of getting those community hubs up and running as well, so that local authorities become more of a gateway to services generally.
OK, Michelle Haywood, MHK, is on Man in Line today till 1. Call, text, email and WhatsApp.
This is the Isle of Man talking the Man in Line.
Charity of the Week, brought to you by Kell Properties.
St German Cathedral Foundation for Music and the Arts' overarching mission is to promote, preserve, and grow the musical and artistic life of the cathedral, support young musicians, and enrich the cultural life of the Isle of Man through high-quality choral and musical activity offered as a gift to our island community. For more information, visit cathedral.im.
This advert is brought to you by Kell Properties.
Give your home a facelift with Manx Glass and Glazing. Whether choosing aluminium or UPVC in traditional or contemporary styles, you can be sure of excellent workmanship and guarantees. Members of Construction Isle of Man and family run for over 40 years, Manx Glass and Glazing are committed to the local community, and they invest in future generations through their apprenticeship scheme. Visit the impressive showroom on Snugbridge Trading Estate. Trust Manx Glass and Glazing. Quality and style since 1986.
Patricia Wild Opticians is celebrating over 30 years of friendly, caring service in Farmhill and Ramsey. Visit us for professional eye care with stress-free parking. Phone Patricia Wild Opticians on 813
977.
The exclusive Karcher store is open with thousands of products, accessories and parts in stock. For Karcher sales and service, Hersham Electrical, Shipyard Industrial Estate, Ramsey.
The Illegal Eagles return to the Villa Marina on Saturday the 4th of April. Don't miss the ultimate celebration of the music of the Eagles, a critically acclaimed masterclass in showmanship that brings the legendary back catalogue to life. Book now at villagaiety.com or on 600 555. Take it to the limit with the Illegal Eagles, Saturday the 4th of April. Presented by RS Promotions and supported by your nation station, Manx Radio.
The latest edition of Manx Radio's Breath Mindfulness podcast with Karen Hardman is available now.
And welcome to my Mindful Spa experience.
Brought to you by the Good Health Store on Station Road in Port Erin.
Exhaling slowly, releasing any fragments of stress. Ready for your spa session.
The latest in the Breath Mindfulness series with Karen Hardman and available now at manxradio.com.
You tell yourself, I'm letting go of things that zap my energy. I'm letting go right now.
The Man in Line with Andy Wint.
And Michelle Haywood is here today. This is a message in from Denise saying, do you still believe in the Komen system, this collective responsibility system?
Do I still believe in having executive government, which would be Komen? Yes, I think that's probably the only way that you can do it in the size of legislature that we have. Collective responsibility is always going to be necessary as part of that, because it would be almost impossible to do anything unless you had an agreed government position on moving things through. So I think it... as it's set up, that's probably about the best it can be. Do I still believe in it? I haven't investigated what the alternatives might be. But if you only elect 24 members and you take out one to be speaker and you only have 23 left, there's a really small executive that you can select from that. And so I think possibly the number of departments is about right. You couldn't make it much larger than that, or half the House of Keys would be in on the Council of Ministers, which would mean everything that there was decided there rather than on the floor of Keys.
Okay, Erin dropped a note in just to say before the last election, I think, and during the last election, people were talking about rationalising the DOI, but it doesn't seem to happen. Having had experience within DOI, I mean, it's an enormous department, which I'm sure it does have good news coming out of it, but it tends to get swamped by the bad news.
It's an enormous department, probably with a bit of a communications problem. So I think if you look at DOI, there were attempts made to reform it, and everyone says rationalising it like it's just cut headcount. But cutting headcount doesn't account for the services that the DOI still needs to deliver. And the DOI did go out to look and say, well, what can transfer where? So, for example, you've seen port security is transferred to the Department of Home Affairs and Justice. It's gone into the police force. That's moved. Patient transport is moving back to Manx Care to take over. But if you start going through everything else that the DOI does, in order to cut headcount, if that's the intention, you have to cut something.
Yeah.
Now, the government is working on the One Government Estate project, which will take out the management of the government estates and will take out about 200 staff from the DOI. So the DOI has got smaller. But those staff will still exist within government. They will just exist probably with a statutory board model, which I think is where that's going to go. And so they, they're kind of... It's not that they're not... headcount, but those functions have got to move elsewhere.
Right. Things like the buses. I mean, the buses used to be, when we had a Ministry of Tourism, the buses used to be in tourism. It all got amalgamated. Tourism went off into economic development and just only appears now as a visit Isle of Man. And obviously now DOI has been lumbered with the buses. And does anybody know what's going to happen with the buses? Because nobody seems... We know that the unions are on one side and the department's on the other side, and the public are in the middle, licking their fingers and sticking them in the air, wondering when there's going to be a bus. Can you see any way through this?
I'm going to express, I have a lot of sympathy with the bus drivers in this one. And I know, I mean, this had started in my time as minister, and I know some of the early offers that were on the table to them. But staff matters are mostly dealt with by officers, not at ministerial level.
Right.
So the politicians don't tend to get directly involved in it. And given that I'm not an industrial relations trained negotiator, probably with good reason that politicians don't get involved in those discussions. But I do have some sympathy with the bus drivers, because we are asking them to do shifts that sometimes start at sort of 4:30, 5 o'clock in the morning, and sometimes involve them not finishing until the early hours. They don't get notified about their shifts very far in advance. And equally, I've got some sympathy with the the department because paying people weekly is just such an archaic practice, and it costs money to keep running payroll counts weekly. And so shifting that to a monthly payment system would be far more sensible for everyone. I genuinely believe, although the bus drivers are aligned to the PSE pay grades, they're not on the same, exactly the same terms and conditions, and to a certain extent it's probably unaffordable for them to be on the same terms and conditions, because the PSE grades are set out essentially around office workers, you know, on a sort of 9-to-5 contract. And so once you start getting outside of those hours, it starts getting really expensive. But I do think there has to be some sort of uplift that says, you know, if you're working after 9 o'clock or 10 o'clock at night, or if you're having to come in before 7 o'clock in the morning, or if you're having to do evenings, that there should be some uplift that goes with that. Now, that means it costs money, but in fairness, government found money when the doctors had an 8% pay rise, and those doctors' salaries and that 8% pay rise was far more expensive than it would be to go back to Treasury and say, actually, this is what fair and reasonable looks like from our side, with an uplift for those unsociable hours. I think it's really hard for anyone who works in any of our service sectors, whether it's hospitality or it's driving buses or it's the tourism industry, is that you will always be called on to work what are antisocial hours, and that will mean that you miss family events occasionally, and that you can't have control over, you know, your working day in the way that you would like to. And I think in all of those cases that actually people deserve a little bit of recognition from that in their pay.
And what do you think the public are thinking about all this?
I've been speaking to my constituents this weekend, and they're utterly miserable about not having a bus service. I think one of the things that if you compare us to other jurisdictions, we know is our bus service is absolutely superb. The frequency of buses, the standard of buses, the fact that the fleet is so, I was going to say so new, although we've just got three buses that are painted in the old colours, but the fleet is a new, you know, the fleet is well maintained, they're reliable. All of that is really, really appreciated. And it's a service that is subvented by government. Half the cost of running the buses is actually paid for out of taxes.
Would it help if the public had more detail? Because all the public hear at the moment, the cookie dropped this message in just to say, all we ever hear is, his words, that woman from the union saying that pay and conditions need improving. And then we hear the government saying that talks are ongoing and we haven't reached a deal yet.
It's standard government policy that when you're in a negotiation, you do the negotiations in the room or in the neighbouring room, if that's how it's being managed, rather than trying to do it through the media. The unions involved obviously want to publicise what they're doing, but it doesn't necessarily suit a negotiating stance to be keep putting things on the radio. So, you know, rather than doing interviews, I'd kind of encourage them to get in the room and sort it out. And I think there needs to be a what does good look like, and even if the minister has to turn around and go back to the Treasury Minister, who did actually say there is contingency funding that could be applied for, and that was exactly how the doctor's pay rise was funded. So I think perhaps it's time for the minister to say, okay, what does it look like? What do we need to give our bus drivers so they feel like they are truly valued members of the DMI staff, and they feel like they're getting, you know, adequate reimbursement for their services? And I think the other bit from the department's perspective is that all the bus drivers need to end up on one contract, because it's nonsense to have two or three contracts varying around. You need to get everyone on the one contract so you know exactly what you're dealing with all the time, and that needs to be fair and reasonable.
Okay, non-attributable, completely unscientific. Is the strike going to be over before TT, do you think?
The way things are going at the moment and what I'm hearing, I'm not confident that it is, and that is an absolute crying shame. And the government really needs to get a grip on this one.
Michelle Haywood, MHK's on Man in Line. We're back to the phones in a moment.
Save 17% on the Loganair Tartan Sale with promo code SALE17. Book now at loganair.co.uk. TCs and exclusions apply, subject to availability.
Ethel Garage in Ballasalla doesn't just service and repair any make or model of car. They also operate a recovery vehicle to rescue you and your vehicle from anywhere on the island.
See? Aren't you glad we went to Ethel?
for top quality work from Nissan factory trained technicians, dedicated aftercare, and now recovery too. Athol, a garage to swear by, not swear at. Book now at athol.im or call the A-team whenever you need them. 820082.
Stock arriving weekly at Ramsey Garden Centre. Discover potted spring bulbs, summer bulbs, seed potatoes, onion and garlic sets, wildflower seeds, sweet pea, microgreens, plantable biodegradable pots and propagation essentials. Grow smarter, greener, season after season with Ramsey Garden Centre.
Direct cremation is just that. An affordable and simple cremation without all the costs associated with a funeral service. Find out more by visiting directcremation.im or phone Direct Cremations on 478 422.
You may have noticed a little more noise than usual on Victoria Street. That's because Conister Bank is having a makeover. We're refurbishing our office to create an even better experience for our customers, but it's business as usual. You can still visit us. Our temporary reception is just one floor up with our sister company Edgewater. The same team, the same friendly faces, and the same trusted service. We've been here for 90 years, and we're here to stay. Conister Bank, built on trust, focused on you.
A ground source heat pump can save thousands of pounds a year, and you can harness this energy on island with Geothermal Limited, the water borehole experts. Visit drilling.im and see how a ground source heat pump borehole works. That's drilling.im.
Are you a small charity here on the Isle of Man? Are you looking for volunteers, hoping to raise awareness and chasing those crucial pounds and pennies to support your work? Well, Manx Radio can help. You could be our next 1-3 Charity of the Week. With daily on-air coverage, podcast and social media promotion, we can help support you and those you help. Just email the numbers 123 at manxradio.com and listen out for the feature each weekday between 1 and 3pm. The Charity of the Week, brought to you by Kell Properties.
The Man in Line with Andy Wint.
And Michelle Haywood is here. This is a Texter 641. I'll ask this now. We're going to ask it anyway before the end of the show. Can you ask your guest if she's standing for re-election in September?
Short answer is yes.
Jolly good. We've got that off the table now. And when might the DOI, Diane, this is, when might the DOI tidy up the main Ballasalla Road as there are potholes everywhere? I understand that the big job might not get completed for a while, but it's a main commute and should be kept in a better state.
Not sure which Ballasalla Road we're talking about. The one past the airport?
Is it the
maybe?
One that we talked about last time with the collapsing bridge? Where's the collapsing bridge? Just by Santon, isn't it?
Oh, the Santon Road. So yeah. The scheme for that was drawn up a couple of years ago, I think, well before I was minister. It would involve, and people can consider this now, so it would involve shutting the road off for 6 months. It is too narrow to have the road being worked on whilst there is traffic flow past it. So there's no traffic lights option. It would mean rerouting the traffic either via the old Castle Town Road or via St Mark's. Now, if you want to speculate on what the impact that would be on traffic flow from the south, just consider what happened when they closed Whitehoe last week and the impact that that had on the whole island from the south. It was just, I think the knock-on effects were huge. And that was just a temporary closure that absolutely needed to happen. So to rebuild that road is a major undertaking. It's 6 months of disruption. And there are some real challenges about getting large vehicles, buses and HGVs south through those diversion routes. The bridges over the old Castletown Road will take those vehicles, but obviously you've got the difficult turnout at Blackboards to get back on the main road. So I think that's a scheme that is somewhere behind the Balthane roundabout being finished and the Balthane bypass, but it is on the horizon that it needs to be done. And at the same time as that's done, the railway bridge will be tackled as well. But it will be a major, major disruption for the island.
OK, and talking of the Balthane roundabout, the Balthane roundabout.
The Balthane roundabout. As far as I know, work is ongoing to deliver on that, but I haven't seen any updates on when that's likely to start.
OK, and this is it Daryl, who just said, when is the building starting on the old marine biological station in Port Erin? Has that been approved?
They got planning permission for it, yes, and the height of the building had to be reduced slightly to allow for the fact that fulmars nest on the cliff behind, and so the building had to be lowered slightly. I don't know that there's any start date for being on site yet.
What's it going to be? Apartments?
It's apartments, yeah.
How many?
I don't remember, actually. It was quite a few blocks. So it runs from where the old red brick building was, which had the library in it. It runs down the full length of the site. So it was quite a few numbers. And cafes, I think, underneath.
OK. Well, let's get to the phones. And somebody wants to chat with you now, to Michelle Haywood. Eric, Fastamai, good afternoon.
Hi. You doing all right?
Good, thanks.
Hello, Eric.
Yeah. Hi, I just wanted to say thank you for being the first minister in 6 years to bother to do something about the buses and mobility scooters, which is working well now, and which should have been 6 years ago, but thank you for doing it.
Oh, Eric, I don't want you to take too much of this, but I was thinking about you this morning as I remembered I was on the show, and I was thinking, oh, I wonder how Eric's doing. Have you managed to get to the NSC yet?
No, I'm waiting. There's a waiting list for a disabled part. I'm waiting for that. But I'm using the bus 3 or 4 times in the week now. And last week I had an appointment in the Old Nobles and an appointment in New Nobles, and managed that going from Ramsey to Douglas on the bus, then to the Old Nobles, then got the bus up to New Nobles, and then got the bus back home again.
Marvellous. So you've been testing out all the routes, have you?
Oh, yeah. I'll be doing a bit more when it gets warmer as well.
Fantastic. I am so glad to hear that. And I'm so pleased that I was able to help get that over the line for you.
Yeah, well, you were the first one for 6 years.
Right.
Well, you have to apologise now, you see. You kept dismissing all the DOI ministers as useless. At least one of them wasn't.
OK. All right. Thanks, Eric. Yeah, it's good to hear from you. What did you have to do to get that through, Michelle Haywood?
I stamped me to my 7 feet. And there seemed to be just a series of excuses as to why it couldn't happen. And to be fair to the people running the buses, there were lots of things on their plate. There was the bubbling way in the background about potential of industrial action. There were, you know, all sorts of challenges over new buses coming in and maintenance and recruiting people to do various essential tasks within the bus setup. So, you know, management wasn't not doing its job, but equally adding extra things into there just seemed to be a little step too far. So I pushed quite hard, and as well Joni Farragher was in buses, and she was pushing hard for it. And so we ended up kind of setting deadlines and insisting it should happen.
Okay, Juan, you're live with Michelle Haywood. Hi, Juan.
Welcome back, Andy. Hi, Michelle. How are you?
Hello, Juan. I'm fine. How are you?
I'm very good, thank you. Just a couple of comments there. I agree with you with your bits and pieces on COVID and how that changed people's thoughts and reactions since that's happened. I totally agree with you on that. And there's a definite divide on how people look at government after what happened there. Just a little tiny thing there. You talked about the lowering the height on the hotel at the biological station at Portrait, and that's quite interesting. Interesting, considering the big monstrosity that's going to go up in Douglas. So just a little quick point that was on that one.
It was only by one floor. I think they proposed 5 floors, and they've been asked to drop it to 4 just to allow the fulmars a clear kind of access route to their nesting site. So it wasn't a big thing, but that's things go through planning and get an environmental impact assessment, is so those adjustments can be made.
Yeah. Interesting that the Douglas one went ahead the size of that. But anyway, that's not what I came on for. And talking about the, you spoke with Julian before about the access bill, the safe access bill. And of course, there was a few onerous sections in that, the premises definition, protected premises, and bits like that, which we've spoke about for probably 12 months now. It seemed to be from what you said there to Julian that vaccination hubs are going to be covered in that. But obviously, we can't talk about anything medical on this show anymore after last week's spat, I believe. But I'd just like to ask you on of course the access zone bill. You're the person that put this forward. Was this totally your idea to put this forward, or was this brought to you by one of your members of the department at the time? And if it was your idea, you've read it through fully and agreed with everything at the time.
So the origins of the bill came from partly from the experience I spoke about earlier of going and visiting a scientific establishment, but also from discussions that I'd had with people when I was a member of the Department of Health and Social Care. And it just seemed to me to be almost slightly paradoxical that we'd protected people who would access abortion services. Quite clearly, there's several clauses in the Abortion Reform Act around protecting access to those services, that we didn't offer the same protection to other services, even though they were legal and legitimately applied. Added to which, I've had parents approaching me about their children being accosted on the way into schools when they're going in for vaccinations. Those vaccinations are safe and legal. And you are right that we are not going to discuss the validity of that, because it's scientific fact, and neither of us are here to give out medical advice. But if they, my contention is that if services are being provided which are legally being provided, then anyone who's seeking to use those services should have the right to do so without being accosted, interfered with, approached, lobbied, or given any information at all about it. The information should come from the service provider to the person using the service, or their parents, for them to make an informed judgment.
All right, final word, Jewel. Just about out of time. Just a brief final word.
Absolutely. So briefly, just back to my point, what was it your idea to bring this through in its entirety, or was that a copy and paste legislation that's happening in the UK?
Okay.
No, it's a private member's bill. So this was me initially working from the Abortion Reform Act, and then I've had a look at other jurisdictions have started to look at similar approaches to having the protection around abortion clinics, haven't extended it yet to other facilities, but there are stories from across other similar jurisdictions where there have been problems around those other facilities. So it's a private member's bill, and it came from me.
Okay. I want to get this in at the end. Nicholas said, you're on the Select Committee for Tobacco and Nicotine Products.
Yep.
Has the problem of youth vaping got out of control, do you think?
I'm just working on the final draft of the report to come back from that committee to the House of Keys, which has some recommendations for changes in legislation to come. It doesn't specifically address vapes, but it might address controlling nicotine-containing substances in the future.
Okay. Well, you heard it. Candidate for the constituency of Russian this coming September, Michelle Haywood, has been with us. And thanks for being with us today. It's good to see you.
Thank you very much, Andy.
All the very best.
That's a lot.
That's it. Remember, on Friday, David Ashford is here, Cabinet Minister. We're open line tomorrow. WINT.